This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Hi, this is Sarah Kay, founder of Equal Time for Free Thought. You're listening to WBAI New York, your peace and justice radio. Now more than ever, you've got to believe in equal time for free thought.
And good evening, everyone. My name is Barry Seibin, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought. On this program, we promote and defend a socio-political philosophy called humanism, which is informed by scientific naturalism, as we examine how such a philosophy can facilitate progressive social change. Tonight, we have the pleasure of speaking with Beth Lamont, the widow of famous humanist Corliss Lamont, as we discuss her new book and other ideas about Corliss's humanism and humanism in general. But first, here's an announcement for an event occurring for Darwin Day in the local area. On Saturday, February 7th, from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock p.m., the New York Society for Ethical Culture will present a Darwin Day Family Festival. Speakers will include Professor of Philosophy John Tehan, Executive Director of Council of Churches Reverend Tom Goodhow, and our own Arnell Doré. There will be plenty of activities for children, including evolutionary exploration, a scavenger hunt, primate paintings, songs, stories, fossil making, and more. The New York Society for Ethical Culture is located at 2 West 64th Street on the corner of West 64th Street and Central Park West in Manhattan. Admission to the event is less than the price of a movie for adults, and admission for children is free. For more information, call 212-874-5210. That's 212-874-5210. Or visit World Wide Web, NYSEC.org. In 1970, upon reading The Philosophy of Humanism by Corliss Lamont, San Francisco-born Beth Keener realized she was a practicing humanist. Having disavowed traditional religion for more than 30 years, she wrote to Lamont, thanking him for giving her beliefs a name. They eventually met and in 1986 were married. Beth Lamont is a feminist activist, humanist, and mother of 11. In the 1970s, she became a board member of the American Humanist Association through its chapter assembly. Additionally, she has headed the Division of Humanist Extension, assuming this leadership role at the invitation of Edwin H. Wilson, created a humanist advocate program which encouraged individuals to promote humanism, created a television program called Here and Now, which has aired on Manhattan Cable since 1984, is a humanist chaplain having performed over 500 weddings, and has represented the American Humanist Association in its NGO capacity at the United Nations. Beth has recently self-published the book Lefties Are in Their Right Minds, which includes a reintroduction and fresh commentary to Corliss Lamont's 1939 text, You Might Like Socialism. I have to say here that Beth was with us when Sarah Kay first introduced Equal Time for Free Thought to WBAI audiences back in the summer of 2002 and appeared on the show periodically. So, a long-awaited welcome back to you, Beth Lamont.
Hello, Barry.
This program will follow from a show you, Beth, and did with Barry Beatty way back when it was more of a conversation between two people. This time it'll be you and me. For this, and I'm sure Sarah Kay is listening, she will correct me, you and I.
Yes.
For this show, you and I will be talking about a few general topics whereby I'll ask you a question, and then we'll have sort of an unscripted-styled discussion on that question. I have a total of about five, I think, which might be the most important questions one would want to ask of the wife of one of the most important humanists in American history, the late Corliss Lamont. So here we go. Humanism has a long history, from the ancient Greeks to the Renaissance to the Enlightenment, up through the various humanist manifestos, which we can talk about later, and the recent advent of secular humanism. I happen to think that if one were to take a look at this history and the key philosophical and ethical considerations they entail, one could today summarize humanism in a fairly clear fashion, while leaving room for some debate and a future of change we cannot readily predict at this time. Corliss began writing in the early early part of the 20th century and lived to see many changes the United States and the world went through right up to the Clinton years. So to begin, if you can talk a little bit about what Corliss understood humanism to be early on, and if he had changed any of that understanding based on the changes in the world by the time he got to the end of his life.
Well, let me say, first of all, I do believe that the inauguration of Barack Obama is a culmination of humanist philosophy. And the American Humanist Association has an ad in the Washington Post of triumph, you know, celebrating that Obama was raised as a secular humanist. Corliss would be ecstatic with what's going on today. This is just such a tremendous triumph. We have work to do, of course. And you were asking about his feelings over the years. I would say that his dedication to humanism and the humanist philosophy did not waver. But early on, you mentioned already 1939 when he wrote, "You Might Like Socialism." I quip. They didn't like it then. They don't like it now. But that's what we need. I don't believe that his philosophy about humanism changed from that time. But he was trying to be very careful to insulate the philosophy and talk about pure philosophy. And because socialism and socialist ideas were being maligned, Wall Street didn't want to share any wealth, and organized religion was frightened. These Bolsheviks over there smashing icons of the church, this is alarming. And so I think this was really a collusion. We must stop this conspiracy that would go on like wildfire. It would inspire workers and this kind of thing. So I do believe this reaction was intended to stop socialists and socialist ideas and union organizing and all the things in behalf of the betterment of the people.
So in insulating humanism from socialism or other political values that Corliss might have personally held, what did that leave the humanism to be? How did he define humanism minus the socio-political economic characteristics?
I don't know. He kept saying pure philosophy. And American Humanist Association, there were so many issues that we needed to talk about, nuclear proliferation, abortion, and things like that. And so it was taking a stand saying that we must have more information, the freedom of information, the public's right to know, things like this. And I really believe that they were fearing alienating part of the populace.
So you would say he was sort of advocating for a more open democracy. That was the key to pure humanism, open society.
I believe so. Okay. But I don't know that Corliss really took place. You know, the American Humanist Association was doing its thing. It needed membership.
Right.
It needed
it had its own agenda of sorts, all organizations
would. Always. That's the first requirement, to sustain oneself. But Corliss's heart was always in the same place. You know, that humanism is meeting the needs of human beings. I think that Hugo Chavez said it very well. He was speaking at the United Nations, and he said, "Left is where the heart is." And of course, that is it, to meet the human needs. And that's why I claim to be a humanist rather than an atheist. I believe that humanism is all-inclusive, to embrace, respect all cultures, all people on the face of this earth.
Yes. Before we lose track of the comment you said, it won't need much explaining on WBAI, but everyone on BAI and elsewhere know the quip. I think that started with Winston Churchill and a few others, that leftist politics is heart-based politics, but their argument is it's not brain-based argument politics. So the argument is like, you know, when you're young, you would be heartless not to be a leftist. But once you mature and get more intellectually astute, then you become a conservative, because then you realize the leftism is too idealistic.
But idealism is what we need. And get the money, honey, is the mantra of capitalism. And what does conservative even mean? That means to conserve what you have. Well, damn it, if you don't have it, you need it. If you don't have health care, if you don't have education, if you don't have a job, you don't have a home to live in, all of these things, this is part of the humanist philosophy.
Right, and these things aren't just emotional. They're intellectual, you can say, because they're talking about real human needs.
Real human needs.
So that quip, therefore, goes by the wayside as far as we're concerned. But I just want to to play devil's advocate for a minute, because I'm sure there'll be somebody who will be listening will say, but. So Corliss saw a lot of interesting things happening. I mean, he wrote that essay on socialism in 1939, as World War II was just getting going, for the United States at least.
Right.
So then he lived through that. He lived through Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then eventually through Vietnam and the 60s movements, the good and the bad that came from that.
Right.
And then the rise of Reaganomics and the victory of conservative economics again. By the time he was in his late 80s, early 90s, I believe he lived to, what, 93?
93.
Right.
You're right.
He saw a lot of stuff, and yet he wasn't ever – and he also saw the collapse of the Soviet Union. He saw the kind of socialism that took place there and how disastrous it was for a lot of people under Stalin and Mao, although I know there were communists on this very program that will argue against that idea that it was so bad.
Right.
But it was enough that it wasn't doing socialism good in its name.
Right.
But he didn't waver from his ideology.
He stood firm. I think Corliss's attention started in 1917. And he was so excited about the Bolshevik Revolution. But he's a child of Wall Street wealth. Think of that. His father was a J.P. Morgan partner. And a whole story there. That's so interesting. But he learned right at the family dining table that capitalism did not benefit the people. You know, he learned about people who are out of work because the plant closes down, or people lose their homes because they're foreclosed, or the attempt to organized labor is thwarted. And all of these things he took to heart, and he began to champion the so-called underdog. He even went to jail in support of strikers in New Jersey. So he championed this part of the humanist philosophy that is in harmony with socialism. Well, I was going to say,
okay.
And socialism has been so maligned. You know, the McCarthy era, it would just strike terror in people.
The evil empire.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. People couldn't separate, I don't think, the philosophical and even ideological tenets of what socialism was from what was happening in so-called socialist countries that weren't democratic.
Well, listen to this. Any organization or any ideal, if it's concentrating on perpetuating itself and protecting itself from onslaught, sabotage from within or from without, you know, it becomes totalitarianism. This is the thing, no matter how ideal. He was championing the idea that this was a people's revolution, the soldiers, the sailors, the farmers, and they were throwing off the Tsar and other vested interests and the church.
Right. So you think that it was the counter-revolutions from within, say, Russia and the Soviet Union, or from the capitalist world outside of the Soviet Union, which was creating or leading to the leadership, like with Lenin, for instance, to become more totalitarian, less democratic, in order to protect what it...
Right. Well, we were intent on destabilizing
it. Right. Well,
right.
But could not have been, and I don't want to get too far off on the politics.
We can't even deal with Cuba on our doorstep.
Yeah, I know.
Capitalism is embarrassed to have a surviving socialist country right on
our... Well, that's why they tried to overthrow Chavez and everybody
all
else.
Of these things.
But also, at least with the Soviet Union, I'm not as certain about Mao's China, but maybe to some degree. The fact that in order for these countries to have a movement which is antithetical to what the rest of the powerful world wants, they decided that the best way to go about it was having the power of the movement isolated in a few hands. It didn't stay a people's movement for long, is what I'm saying. Right. And I think once it moved from a people's movement to the movement of the party,
That's right.
Vanguard, then you had what you have in other non-democracies. You have the, and in democracies that are pseudo-democracies, like the United States, you have the power elite controlling
exactly.
the movement.
Exactly.
And once you have that, you've lost socialism.
Your ideal.
An ideal, right.
Whether it's democracy.
Right.
Or.
We're not immune, that's for sure.
That's it.
How would Corliss's humanism differ from today's humanism? I'm asking this because Corliss's humanism, as we just discussed, didn't really waver too much. He had an idea of what humanism was all about, and he attached it to some degree to a political ideology because he saw that ideology as bringing about the kind of ends the humanists wanted.
And saw how it was being thwarted.
Right.
We cannot have a democracy as long as the focus is on the monetary. You know, this is so ironic. What we have right now, after the Wall Street free fall, now we have socialized capitalism. Just think of that. The taxpayers. And the taxpayers, some of them don't even get it.
Yeah.
That they have been exploited
so
in order to support the free market.
Yeah.
This is
socialism for the car companies and for the great bailouts of Wall Street, but not for the people who are subsidizing this socialism.
Right.
Hello, my name is Annie Drian, founder of Cosmos Studios. You're listening to Equal Time for Free Thought, brought to you by WBAI New York, your peace and justice radio.
Corliss didn't waver. He really believed his ideas were still on target through everything he saw. But humanism itself, at least the way it's presented by organized humanism in this country. I speak to people in the current humanist organized movement. People know who listen to the show. I was part of one of these organizations in the past when I first started the show. The way humanism is being defined is that it's a human-centered method of inquiry. That far just sounds like it could be atheism. It doesn't sound like anything special. And then they add in it's an ethical worldview. But then when I approach these organizations about their ethics, what are these ethics you're talking about? They'll give you a long list of what the ethics are, sort of in a vague kind of philosophical sense. But when I ask them to apply it to real life events, they suddenly back down.
Barry, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
Taking a moral stand, an ethical stand, what's going on in so many places around the world that are harming human beings? You know, this is where humanism is. Our concern must be with the human beings of this earth. You know, people can talk about some other realm. I wanted to say that one of my favorite visions is a picture of Earth taken from a satellite. And you think in all the systems of galaxies, this looks so ideal. You know, a beautiful blue-green planet and where people ought to be able to live safely and happily. And I'm sure it's so strange if an astronomer were looking. How would they know that we're still torn apart in this kind of war and hatred and fear, while some people are aspiring to, and this is so ironic, to some other celestial realm where they can live happily ever after, instead of facing things right here on this earth.
My discussions with some current humanists from humanist organizations, the question of what is humanist or what do humanists believe, they have no problem, for instance, defending humanists being atheists or non-believers. That seems straightforward enough.
Mm-hmm.
But again, when it comes to applying the ethics that are in the manifestos, humanist manifestos and other texts, they hesitate. And I brought up atrocity going on in Gaza. I know it's a very complicated situation, particularly in the United States, because a lot of Americans don't have the full history of Israel. And what actually has happened over the last 50, 60 years. But when I ask some people in these organizations, do they see this as a humanist concern? And if they do they take a position? And not only do some of these people don't think it's even a humanist concern, don't even write it, put it in their magazines, But if they would, if I pushed them to discussing it, they would give me arguments that you can be a humanist and take the Zionist side as much as you can be a humanist and take the Palestinian side. I'm asking them then, what are these so-called ethics that you are basing these positions on? And the conversation usually stops because, you know,
it's not justifiable. Whether these are Israeli lives or Palestinian lives, the whole thing is so inhumane. And the only way that we can stop and solve these very, very human and very intricate problems is through international accord. I'm at the United Nations. I believe, well, you mentioned the Humanist Manifesto. Right. This is the 60th year of the Declaration of Human Rights. And it's a shame because this is a work in progress also. We have not achieved any of its goals. People are still in jeopardy. Whole populations, there's so much injustice and perpetration of militarism on the face of this earth. And I grieve for all the people who are suffering as a result of this, and I champion the United Nations as an instrument that can solve these problems. Yes, we can, but it has been so maligned, so undercut, underfunded, badmouthed, a useless debating society. What we have is the Insecurity Council that perpetuates, here we go again, perpetuating its own power. Never mind, it's not acting in the best interests of the people of Earth. This is shameful. I'm hoping that the Obama presidency can turn this around. I like the fact that he has given Susan Rice, who's knowledgeable about Africa, putting her as our ambassador to the United Nations.
Do you think ultimately if he sustains a more liberal, which he may have to do in order to help our economic system, you know, a new deal as people are talking about, a new FDR kind of liberalism, do you think that liberalism, though closer to humanist ideals, will meet humanist ideals based on the fact that humanism is still a capitalist humanism?
It's a step in the right direction. I really do. Awareness and recognizing that we are one member of the family of nations. You know, this is something that Americans have become, or at least our foreign policy and its assertions, is so arrogant and so chauvinistic, you know, that we have to be the policemen of the world. Well, we have done some good things, and most Americans believe that we are the good guys. I feel so sad about this. I would love for us to be the good guys.
You decided to reissue a classic essay by Carlos Lamont called You Might Like Socialism.
Right.
In a larger context, which includes your own writing, and you've called this book Lefties Are in Their Right Mind, love the title. I'd like to first talk about that essay in the context of when it was written, back in the late 30s, when socialism in the United States, you know, was being maligned, but not quite as strongly as it has since World War II. And then have you talk about how you've brought the essay up to date with your own comments.
Well, I've been blogging for quite a while, and you can find my blog on humanvalues, that's all one word, .net. Also, Lefties, you can read it online, and that's at Corliss-Lamont.org.
Spell Corliss for people.
It's Corliss, and then a hyphen, Lamont, Lamont.org.
Okay.
And so you can read Lefties. And Lefties is not anatomical, except left is where the heart is, but it is political. Corliss has talked about a planned economy that's in the best interests of the people. And this is where the workers would have a say about what goes on in the factory. And there needed to be union organizing and planning that's in the best interest, not of the money makers, but that wealth would come from the work of the people. Never mind the profit-making. That's one of the problems with capitalism. Accumulation of wealth. And
it's
skimmed off at the top. The investors who have no sweat.
The investors who have no real investment in the effort.
That's right. This is the frightening thing. Wall Street doesn't want the workers to have more. As a matter of fact, it's the whole name of the game is, if they start to organize, then you take it to some other country where they're glad to have the work.
So now we have a very different kind of society, in global society. Have you included anything new in the updates?
Yes, how we can go about it.
Right.
Well,
yeah, I mean, not even, I mean, I want to get to how we get from here to there, and you can talk about that now. But also, I meant, is the analysis different at all in today's world than it might have been?
I think so. As a matter of fact, Corliss's chapter on actual how to go about it, I removed that respectfully out of its context and put it at the end for historical reference. But my explanation was, in this day when we have at our fingertips a new verb to Google, we can find information. He didn't have any information. You know, it was coming out by ship or something, you know, and who to believe and what to believe. That's why he went to the Soviet Union to see what was going on. But now we have at our fingertips so many tools that we can really democratize our country. Voting, for instance, voting is so unfair. It ought to be uniform throughout. If you can get a receipt from the ATM, you ought to be able to get a receipt from your voting booth. There's another thing, too. Control of the media. Corporations, you know, are doing what's best for them. Always it's get the money, honey. And if you have advertisers, people who want, you know, you want to entice them, you don't want to do anything that is offensive or suspicious or likely to be criticized. You know, our corporate media has become like homogenized, and it goes along with the powerful and the powerful ideas. And instead of rocking the boat, this is what we need to have a democracy, to question everything. I like, what's your theme? You say, pay it forward and question everything.
Right.
Yes. And when some authority speaks, you know, like, by what authority do you assert this? Where did you get your information? When I'm talking about the new technology, Corliss was from the century where you know, revere the written word and the library, but the fact that more people may know about him now than even in his lifetime, he's out there on the World Wide Web, and we get hits every day.
No, that's great. And this book is self-published, but people could read it all as a PDF?
Right.
Online?
I'm hoping to have real copies pretty soon.
Okay. Well, how do people get in contact with you? How do they find you on the website, the Corliss Lamont?
Corliss-Lamont.org.
Not any of your emails there.
Yeah, and you would do /lefties, L-E-F-T-I-E-S, /.
Right.
And the other one, if you'd like to see the beautiful estate, you do CorlissLamont.org/castle.
Mm-hmm. And you also run monthly meetings at
We're meeting now. The Society for Ethical Culture has adopted us.
Oh, that's
the
good.
The Humanist Society of Metropolitan New York
has
a home, so at least temporarily. And we're meeting there on second Tuesdays of every month. The next time will be February 10th.
Thank you, Beth Lamont, for joining us in Equal Time for Free Thought.
This has been fun. And hooray to everybody out there.
And you've been listening to an interview with Beth Lamont, author of the new book, Lefties Are in Their Right Minds, with a reintroduction to Corliss Lamont's You Might Like Socialism. If you missed any part of this program, please visit our archives on our website at World Wide Web, EqualTimeForFreeThought.org. Tonight, Equal Time for Free Thought was engineered by Sean Rhodes and edited by Barry Seidman. Special thanks to our researcher and transcriber, Joel Schlossberg, and as always, to our founder, Sarah Kay. I'd like to mention that Sarah Kay has been ill for some time and might enjoy some greeting cards. She is at the DITMAS, D-I-T-M-A-S, Park Care Facility, which is located at 2107 DITMAS Avenue on the third floor. That's in Brooklyn, New York, 11230. And remember to tune in, pay forward, and question everything. Good night.
Get the money, honey, is the mantra of capitalism. I work